Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and today we are very privileged to be joined by Frances Hui. She is a political activist who has been granted asylum to live here in the United States because of her advocacy for faith and freedom in Hong Kong. And she is also the author of Hostile Takeover, the CCP and Hong Kong's Religious Communities. Frances, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Frances, you just wrote a piece weighing in on Cardinal Chow's comments about persecution, the Catholic Church. And he said some things that I think were surprising. Specifically, he said, there's no persecution going on. And he said explicitly, come and see for yourself. And you responded by saying, I wish I could, but I can't. Tell us more. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so, the Cardinal Chow in his recent remarks, he was saying that there's no religious persecution in Hong Kong, and he invited critics to, you know, come and see for yourself. I think what he meant is, you know, people can still go to mass, they can still worship, churches are still intact. So religious freedom supposedly are fine. But in my perspective, that's different. First of all, I can't take that, you know, invitation because I'm wanted by the Hong Kong government for $1 million bounty on my head for my advocacy in the U.S. for democracy and human rights, for speaking up on Hong Kong issues. Second of all, I think what Cardinal Chow didn't cover is that people's religious lives have fundamentally changed after the CCP have tightened control over the city, especially on the religious sphere. It's across the board that political activism and any topics about human rights and religious freedom can no longer exist in Hong Kong. You would violate the law and you would be arrested and charged. And so people, it's undeniable that the religious lives have changed. The church in Hong Kong has historically been very outspoken on issues related to human rights and religious freedom and the religious persecution in mainland China. As we all know, the situation in mainland China is much more severe, right? Like churches get demolished. People who refuse to take the oath of fidelity to the government are arrested. Just recently, we saw, you know, a major crackdown on one of the Christian church, underground church. And so Hong Kong used to be that church that would speak up for those people that are persecuted in China. We no longer can do that anymore. And so, you know, when Cardinal Chow says religious freedom is still intact, and he also said that Beijing wants Hong Kong to have religious freedom because Hong Kong is important. He just missed out this part about this whole of practicing your faith and living out your life under this faith. It's part of religious freedom too. It's, you know, how we're during masses, when sermons are being censored, when priests no longer can talk about what's going on in the society, what's affecting the people on the ground, it's very hard to tell the story of Jesus. It's very hard to tell the Bible story and to relate to people's life. And so we obviously see people struggling with their faith in Hong Kong because they don't no longer see leadership from the church, no longer see someone who would, you know, stand up for them, especially for, you know, Cardinal Chow, with his moral authority as the Bishop of Hong Kong. You know, he has the position to speak up for the voiceless, and it's disappointing that he didn't. And I think this is not just my perspective. I have heard many of the Catholics around the world, like especially Chinese Catholics and Catholics from Hong Kong, many share the same sentiment. Even people, priests in Hong Kong, in the Hong Kong diocese, they have concerns over his remarks.
Well, and his comment certainly does seem off key, especially, you know, as we saw last week that the wife and daughter of Jimmy Lai, who is probably the most well-known, he's become almost the face of Hong Kong, really. He's certainly become the face of conscience rights to the world, continues to languish in a, you know, in solitary confinement. Tell us, what has Cardinal Chow said about Jimmy Lai, and how do people like you who've really suffered for your courage view the church's kind of unfortunate silence on Jimmy Lai's case?
Yeah, so I would say Cardinal Chow and the church leadership has not once mentioned Jimmy Lai's case publicly, and we know that he personally has never reached out to Jimmy, and that's something I also covered in my piece. And we know that Jimmy Lai, as you said, he has been suffering from solitary confinement for as long as his trial has started. It's been 5 years since he last have freedom out of Hong Kong prison. And he doesn't have regular access to the Holy Communion. And I think that's a fundamental religious right for someone to have regular access, for a Catholic, a devout Catholic, to have regular access to Holy Communion, even though they are behind prison walls. He's not even convicted yet, and he's stripped away from his, you know, religious rights. And the Hong Kong diocese doesn't seem to have fought for his rights. This is the very minimal thing that the Catholic Church should do, to, you know, especially since this case is also very prominent, very well attended by the international community, global Catholic community. People want to see some kind of, you know, support from the leadership, from the church, from the Hong Kong church, and we're not seeing that. And for myself, I am, you know, I have been Catholic since I was baptized as a baby. I have never, you know, like I've never really received any, like, no one reached out to me from the Hong Kong diocese to try to support, or any, like, to provide at least some kind of pastoral care or whatnot. Like, I think the Hong Kong church has kind of separates themselves from touching the political issue, and they probably see that because I'm being repressed. I am facing repression because of my political activism, because of the fact that I support democracy and human rights, and that's not what the CCP like. And Jimmy Lai too, he's not really arrested because of practicing faith, but if we really think about it, technically he is, and I am too, because we were taught as a Catholic to speak up, to speak the truth, to stand with the truth, to speak for the voiceless, to stand up for the oppressed. And that's exactly what we do in our political activism, because people's voice is not being listened by the CCP. Our freedom is being stripped away. And so we're speaking up for the silenced, and that's why we are being punished. We're taking the consequences. So that's part of us practicing our Catholic faith, and that was what we were punished for. And so I think Cardinal Chow doesn't really see that way. And I think the increase engagement he has and the church has with the Chinese side could sometime make them adopt more and more of that Chinese rhetoric. And so that's why, I don't know if that's the reason why, but, you know, we're seeing church leadership, they're using CCP language. They are speaking up on the oppressed ends instead of the oppressing end, instead of the community that are being silenced and oppressed.
You mentioned that you were baptized Catholic. Tell us about your faith journey and how it is that you came to be such an outspoken advocate, and even how, you know, your journey to the United States and being someone with a bounty on their head.
Well, the Catholic faith has always been a huge part of my childhood. I grew up in a Catholic family. Everyone is very devoted, and I was a part of the altar service in my church, and my family, it's more so like we're in the Salesian community too. So growing up, I was part of the Salesian youth movement, and Cardinal Zen. Cardinal Zen is also a Salesian, and so I think part of Salesians' spirits and value is to be with the young people and stand with them no matter what in what's situation. And I totally feel that when I grow up, like I have lots of peers, young peers, that we're all in share the same faith. And I think I look up to, I think overall the church has, like I said, has always been historically been very outspoken on issues related to human rights and religious freedom. And I think very naturally, because of that background, I care a lot about people who are not able to speak for on their own, people that are that have their voice stripped away, people who are underprivileged, and people that need help. I think I'm not the most wealthy people person. I don't have a wealthy background, but I think whatever I can provide, care or whatever I can do, I would always want to help people who are underprivileged or underserved. That's how I was raised by my family, and so I guess naturally when it comes to Hong Kong's situation, it's just very naturally that I should be standing on the silenced side, like the oppressed side. I do believe that as a Catholic, our fundamental value is to be the voice of the voiceless, and we should care for people who are underserved. And so, I guess it's just very nat like it just come as an instinct that I want to fight for the future of Hong Kong and Hong Kongers' rights to express themselves, and that it's not that doesn't work well with the CCP, the controlling party of Hong Kong, and so that's why now I'm, in the US as an asylee, and I would say I have a I would say I have a privilege to speak for the people in Hong Kong, because now I'm able to be in the US and I have the freedom to share these things. But Catholics in Hong Kong, they don't. And perhaps Cardinal Chow don't see them, they don't he doesn't hear them, because they are oppressed, they are silenced, they self-censor, and they don't feel safe to share everything with their priest. And so, but I hope this piece would get him to see that actually there are a lot of people in the Catholic community, even Hong Kong Catholics on the ground, and they are looking for leadership from him, and they are looking for courage from him to stand with the truth, and speak for them in this very difficult situation.
In your article, you talk about cynicization, and especially in schools. And reading it reminded me of what I've read about Castro's Cuba, start the indoctrination young. For our listeners who don't understand, what is cynicization, and how is that playing out, and filtering into life in Hong Kong?
Cynicization is not a new concept, although cynicization is not a new concept. For decades, the CCP have been oppressing religious communities, including Tibetans, Uyghur Muslim, and Christians, and many other religions in China. But Xi Jinping put the name on it. He named it cynicization, and what it means is that religion, by for now, would have to infuse patriotic and socialist values. We should basically the party should adapt it into their own religion. So they allow religions to exist only within their control. This is very different from, I think people sometimes confuse sinicization with indigenization, which is a concept that when a religion is brought in a new country, in a different country, their materials will be slightly adapted in their culture. For example, the Bible is translated in multiple different languages when it gets to, different country around the world. But it's different. They have, this is, sinicization is basically changing the teachings, changing the contents of a religion. And you have the United Front Network, United Front Work Department basically controlling the religious affairs in China. So there is a state entity that oversees all the religious communities, religious groups in China. It's different in Hong Kong because Hong Kong is in a different system. It's under the one country, two system principle. So religious freedom has always been kind of protected under the basic law in Hong Kong. But in 2020, China, I think everyone remembers there was like a big protest, a huge movement in 2019, pro-democracy protest. And that's the moment when CCP think that this is enough. We're not gonna let you guys enjoy the freedom like you used to have. So in 2020, in 2020, they imposed something called the National Security Law in Hong Kong. And it really over the board, it pretty much cracked down on all the free speech. Anyone who speak against the CCP, criticize the government, or have pro-democracy values or Western values supported by Western organizations are all criminalized. And so Hong Kong religious freedom obviously are also affected because all the civic liberty are repressed in Hong Kong now. And so we see that the China is slowly, quietly, carefully implementing their policies in China to Hong Kong's religious sphere. And I laid it out a little bit on in the piece on NCR, but also I detail all of that in my report that was published last year. It was, you can see that from every aspect, from education, from just day-to-day like religious teachings and homilies, priest ability to really connect to people through a proper religious teaching. They can no longer do that because everyone censors themselves. There are Catholic organizations that used to speak up for human rights and religious persecution in China. They have changed their scope. They can no longer touch on topics about the church in China or anything related to us, on the diaspora, because that's considered colluding with foreign forces. Which is one of the clause that could that are criminalized under the national security law. So, Hong Kong situation, I always wanted to emphasize, it's not as severe as in mainland China. Like I said, masses and churches are still there, people are still practicing their faith, but it's a soft form of control that are defined by fear, self-censorship, indoctrination, and co-optation.
Well, Frances, we thank you so much for your courage. You are truly an inspiration. And we very much appreciate your time explaining the situation to us. And I commend our listeners to read your article in the National Catholic Register entitled "Hong Kong Catholics Deserve the Church's Leadership, Not Silence." Frances, thank you for your voice. And for all that you do, and for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And to find out more about the Catholic Association and all that we do, you can visit thecatholicassociation.com, and you can find us on social media on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am once again joined by our terrific TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. Monsignor Landry, we're going to talk about Fulton Sheen today and another interesting e-Catholic endeavor. Please tell us about those.
So I was asked to participate in eCatholic's Engage Virtual Summit, and they were focusing on something very close to my work and my heart, which is the whole theme of Made for Mission, that all of us as baptized Catholics, especially strengthened by the sacrament of confirmation, are missionaries, missionary disciples in communion. And so they definitely wanted to have the national director of the Pontifical Mission Society participate with their great speakers that they had lined on up in trying to help American Catholics participating in this program to understand the deep roots of our missionary vocation. And I decided to do Fulton J. Sheen and the Mission of the Church. Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen was my predecessor for 16 years as the Pontifical Mission Society's national director. And we're inching closer, thanks be to God, to his beatification, which I'm working very hard and praying very hard to make sure happens in 2026. So I had the chance for 45 minutes with a camera crew here in my office to record a presentation on Fulton J. Sheen and the way that he sought to help all Americans take up the missionary aspect of our Christianity. And so that was a lot of fun to do, and it was airing yesterday as part of this two-day virtual summit.
Can people get access to that online, Monsignor?
So I'm not quite sure how they're doing it. Initially, it was to sign up for the conference. Some people can afford it, some people can't. My hope is after the conference, they're somehow going to make it possible for people to be able to share it. At least the video is not immediately accessible, but if anybody wants to find out more, they can certainly read the text of what I used to speak, which is available at catholicpreaching.com for free. So people can have access to it. I just think Fulton J. Sheen is one of the most compelling American Catholics of all time. And one of the things that he focused on very much for 16 years of his life, and then gave 40% of all his effects once he died, was on spreading our faith to those places in the world which are too young, too poor, or too persecuted to be able to be self-sustaining.
Coming off on World Mission Sunday, that sounds like a great endeavor. And can you tell us more about your talk and some of the main points that you were trying to get across?
So I tried to stress a few things about Fulton J. Sheen's work in promoting the missions. The first is he shows us by example the priority that missions to all nations means. We've kind of watered down the term mission. Fortune 500 companies have mission statements. Everybody has a mission to bring the faith to his next door neighbor. Mm-hmm. But when the church talks about missions in a strict sense, it's going to those who really haven't yet been evangelized at all. And when we look out at the world today, Betsy, 5.5 of the 8.1 billion people don't know Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So mission to all the nations, or what we call in Latin missio ad gentes, is something that Fulton J. Sheen absolutely prioritized and tried to help us all take more seriously. The second, he used every means he could to try to spread the faith. We can all learn from him when that he used friendship. He used his holy orders every time that he preached, but he was also entrepreneurial on radio. He became the biggest radio star from 1930 to 1950 when radio was new. He became the number one television program as soon as people started to have television sets in their homes with two programs that he had in the 50s and 60s. He wrote over 70 books in order to spread the faith. He wrote thousands of articles. He invented magazines to be able to spread it. Everything he was able to do, he used, which points us to the type of creativity we're likewise supposed to have. Third, he made this the real priority of his life. Mm-hmm. He despite all his business, despite all his travels, despite the 30 hours every week he would have to spend, which is almost a full-time job, preparing for his television program, he used to meet one-on-one with so many converts and get them ready for the faith. He was the instrument God had used to bring several communists to Christianity, several movie stars, several ambassadors, and then lots of people he would just meet on elevators and on street corners. He took that instruction seriously, and he could do it with all his responsibilities. Then what about you? What about me? What about all those who are now listening to us? And then finally, he showed us the way we're supposed to be an effective missionary, because he always focused on the chief content of sharing the faith, which is what? We're trying to share Jesus. We're trying to share, at the same time we point others to Jesus, we're trying to share our faith in him and the difference that makes in a human life. Fulton J. Sheen was always very happy to talk about the witness of his own vocation story, the difference Jesus had made in his life, and the difference he believed Jesus wanted to make in everybody else's life. Oh, he published over 70 books, but his greatest book of all time was the book called Life of Christ, in which he was trying to help us to enter in to the drama of the God-man coming among us. And so we have our own stories. We're not trying to use somebody else's faith secondhand. Fulton J. Sheen, in announcing Jesus, was likewise announcing his faith, and vast multitudes of Americans found that testimony not only credible, but persuasive. And so I tried to elaborate on those points in the 45-minute talk I gave for the Engage Virtual Summit.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am once again joined by our terrific TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry.
You know, your timing is perfect, because I think just a couple of days ago, they broke ground on an institute in Peoria, Illinois, in the Midwest, here where I live, that's going to be a museum dedicated to his life and his work.
In the chancery called the Spalding Center in Peoria, they already have a beautiful kind of one-room museum, but they're converting the place where Fulton J. Sheen went to high school, called Spalding High School. They're converting that into a Sheen Welcome Center and then a Sheen Museum. So they're going to really be propping this up. And I'm happy to say publicly that I have been working with my friend who's the vice postulator of the cause of Fulton J. Sheen in Peoria, Illinois, Monsignor Jason Gray. He and I were in seminary together in two different seminaries, at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and then at the Pontifical North American College in Rome, to revivify the beatification cause of Fulton J. Sheen. And we're both praying hard and we're both working hard in hopes that we will have a beatification of Fulton J. Sheen soon as the bicentenary of the United States next year in 2026. We both are on the same page thinking there'd be no better way for Catholics to be able to mark the 250th anniversary of the blessing of our country, and no greater way for us to look ahead to see how we, as salt, light, and leaven, are supposed to really help our country live up to the high expectations we place in her than beatifying perhaps the most famous American Catholic of all time until the election of Pope Leo XIV as the 267th Peter. So when I met with Pope Leo on October 4th, which was the second time I had the privilege to meet with him, I said that I'm really praying very hard, Holiness, that your fellow Illinois native and my predecessor as the national director for 16 years will soon be lifted to the altars. And Pope Leo didn't commit. He smiled. He heard it very well. And as he was gripping my hands, he simply said, yes. So I'm hoping that he's on the same page as Monsignor Gray, Bishop Tilka there in Illinois, gazillions, to use the technical term, of American Catholics, not to mention Catholics all across the globe, in awaiting the beatification of the sort of one of the greatest preachers that the church has ever had.
Well, we'll be joining you in prayer, Monsignor Landry, and thank you so much for joining us this week on Conversations with Consequences.
God bless you, Betsy.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I am your hostess, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And as part of EWTN Radio and the Catholic Association, every morning the Catholic Association reviews all the latest news and sends our subscribers a curated selection of the most important news of the day, especially that news that affects faith and family. And it is something that you will thank yourself for subscribing to. Our daily media roundup at thecatholicassociation.org.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress, and we are catching up on an important religious freedom case today with Joe Davis of the Beckett Fund. It's set in the town of Quincy, Massachusetts, where two Defenders of Justice statues are not being allowed to be placed on a public building just because they happen to be saints. Welcome to the show, Joe, and please tell us what's going on in Quincy, Massachusetts.
Sure, happy to do that and happy to be here. Thanks for having me. So I think you framed it up pretty well there, actually. So this is a case about the city of Quincy, Massachusetts. It's building a new public safety building, which is a headquarters for its police officers and its firefighters. And in order to trying to beautify that building and make it a good looking space, it wants to erect statues on the building. One of Michael the Archangel, which is an important figure for police officers, and one of Florin, known as Saint Florin to Catholics, who's an important figure for firefighters. Now, these figures are, it's true, Catholic saints, but their significance goes quite a bit beyond that, and they've sort of become identified with the practice of, police officers and firefighters more generally. Police officers and firefighters of many faiths and of no faith are inspired by these figures, are sort of use these figures to symbolize their professions. And the point of the statues is to honor the firefighters and the police officers, to honor the first responders, and not to send some sort of religious message. Nonetheless, the city has been sued by the ACLU. And the ACLU is saying, because these figures are Catholic saints, they have some significance to people of faith, you can't have them in public. I think that claim is wrong. It would require us to tear down quite a bit of public art across this country, and it's going to be an exciting case, and we're making those arguments in court.
Are there any legal precedents, Joe, for cases that are similar to this, whether it involves firefighters and police or just public buildings in general, where maybe the ACLU has, we know that there's been a lot of pushback on Christmas decorations and creches. What do you have in your arsenal to combat this?
Absolutely. Yeah, great question. So there is quite a bit of precedent over this, and it's kind of evolved. There was a time several decades ago when courts were going out and scrubbing away creches and things like that at the Christmas season. But more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has started to recognize that's actually discriminatory against religion, right? Our public spaces are full of lots of different aspects of our culture. And if we try to scrub away just the religious parts, we're going to send a very distorted message about our history and our culture. So recently, there was a big case from the U.S. Supreme Court involving a cross, a World War I memorial cross that was in a sort of public space in Bladensburg, Maryland. And the Supreme Court said, of course, the cross is religious. It's the central image of the Christian faith. That said, it also has this broader meaning in terms of memorializing the war dead. And Bladensburg, Maryland is perfectly within its rights to maintain a cross for that purpose. There have also been cases about the Ten Commandments, right? Of course, the Ten Commandments are religious. Nobody disputes that to many people. But at the same time, they're also a broader sort of foundation of Western law and Western civic morality. And so governments are able to display the Ten Commandments in public spaces. There was a case about the Texas State Capitol building several years ago. And so these are the kind of precedents that are in play here. This is a case that's in Massachusetts and under Massachusetts state law. So the issues are slightly different in that respect. But Massachusetts, like the rest of the country, has many symbols in its public spaces that have religious significance. It has a very rich history of the Puritans and the Pilgrims and all of that. And that history is reflected in Massachusetts' public spaces. So, I think this case is going to implicate a lot of the same principles of the cross case, the Ten Commandments cases that we just talked about.
Do you think it makes any difference that they're Catholic saints? So a cross is used universally throughout all Christian denominations. But what about the fact that they're Catholic? Is there a little bit of anti-Catholic sentiment going on here? Or do you think it's just because it's religious?
Yeah, look, I mean, so figures that are also Catholic saints are part of that same broad tradition of religious displays across the country. So, you know, there's a large equestrian statue of St. Louis in St. Louis, Missouri, right? There's within the
where I live.
Okay, there you go. Well, you're familiar with this. Within the, you know, statuary hall in the U.S. Capitol, each state has sort of given two statues that represent it. There are many Catholic saints that are represented in that, including Junipero Serra from California. So the fact that these figures are also Catholic saints really doesn't take them out of that tradition, you know, and I'd also note that they're more than that, right? So Michael is a Catholic saint. He's also a figure of Jewish scripture, of Islamic scripture. And he has this significance as a defender against wrongdoing. So it's really no surprise that police officers identify with him, military service members identify with him, and, you know, sometimes for entirely non-religious reasons.
Are there any other buildings that you know of in your research that have Michael or Florian on prominently on display?
There are, in fact. There's you know, other fire departments. So first off, many fire departments across the country use something called the Florian Cross. And I suspect that all your audience would be familiar with this. They might not know it's called the Florian Cross, but that's where it comes from. It's associated with the same figure. But, you know, we're aware of a fire department out in California that has a giant mural on the side of Florian, you know, very similar to what Quincy is trying to do here. There are police stations that have had a statue of Michael to commemorate deceased, you know, officers killed in the line of duty. There's even a United States Navy ship that's called the USS Michael Mansour, but it has its symbol on the ship is the arm of an angel holding a sword, which is a reference to Michael, the same figure that Quincy is trying to use to honor and inspire its police officers here. So there's nothing unusual about what Quincy's doing. The only thing that's unusual is that, you know, we're making this big constitutional dispute out of it.
And how is the mayor lining up? On which side is he on, or has he been very vocal, or any other public figures in Quincy?
Yeah, no, the mayor, you know, has chosen these statues in order to honor and inspire his police officers and his firefighters. Like, he understands that these figures are important to his first responders, and that's why he wants the statues to go up. And the first responders have been quite clear in their support for this plan. Like, they've showed up in this lawsuit represented by their unions and said, we want these statues. Like, they will help us do our job better and protect everybody in the city of Quincy, of course, without distinction according to religion. So, you know, the police officers, the firefighters want them, the statues are for them, and they ought to be able to have them.
They were commissioned, the pretty hefty price tag. How much? $780,000, something like that?
Yeah, look, I mean, this is real art. These statues are being prepared by a European-based sculptor.
They're beautiful. Actually.
I'm sorry?
I said they're beautiful.
Right. He's the same sculptor that did statues in Quincy of John Adams and John Hancock, sort of reflecting Quincy's history. He's also been commissioned to do, you know, federal monuments in Washington, D.C. So, you know, this is an effort to honor and inspire first responders. It's also an effort to beautify Quincy's public spaces. And it really shouldn't have to answer for that and you know, in a lawsuit. This is a question for architects and city planners rather than judges.
So what are the next steps, Joe, in this case?
Yeah, so unfortunately, there was a trial judge ruling that agreed with the plaintiffs and said that because these statues have religious meaning, you can't have them on the building. So it sort of temporarily blocked the installation. But the next step is, of course, appeal, which is you know, likely where this case would have been going either way, regardless of what the trial judge said. And so the appeal will be filed in the coming weeks. And we look forward to presenting these arguments to the Massachusetts appeals courts and you know, get them to recognize that, you know, public art is not off limits just because it may have religious meaning to some.
Do you feel like you have a pretty solid case based on your precedent you've talked about and other displays like in California that you mentioned?
Certainly. The precedent, the fact that this is a longstanding tradition, and the fact that this would really work a sea change in terms of what we'd have to go around the country scrubbing away monuments left and right. I don't think anybody wants to do that, and there's certainly no constitutional requirement to do it.
Would this ever get to the Supreme Court if the appeals process were to continue?
It could look. I mean, the claims here are under Massachusetts law. But ultimately, what the plaintiffs are asking for is for a rule that discriminates against religion and says we have to have a public square that's been scrubbed of religion. That has federal constitutional implications, and those questions could absolutely go to the U.S. Supreme Court if the Massachusetts courts don't land in the right place. Although we anticipate and expect them to do so.
We will look forward to watching this case. And thank you so much, Joe Davis of the Beckett Fund, for joining us. To learn more about the Catholic Association, visit us at CatholicAssociation.org to follow everything we do online, print, radio, and in TV. Thanks again for joining us, Joe.
Thanks, Betsy. Appreciate it.
So this morning, my son was reading the front page of the newspaper, and I have 5 kids. 3 of them are, very attuned to what's going on in the world. And he noticed that Bad Bunny is going to be the halftime performance at the Super Bowl. And he's 10 years old, and his response was, "Bad Bunny is going to perform the Super Bowl halftime? That's so inappropriate." And I was startled, and I find it to be such a sad commentary on the time that we live in that a 10-year-old understands that content that's going to be viewed by millions upon millions of children is inappropriate. And he's absolutely right. I mean, Bad Bunny, his performances have been described as demonic. He has a picture of himself in a dress. And I saw a funny Babylon Bee story that was like, "Oh, this is a great way to make overtures to the other side, is make a man who's wearing a dress perform at the Super Bowl halftime." But it's truly sad, and I know that every parent understands that when the Super Bowl halftime show comes on, you pretty much have to turn off the TV and then decide if you're going to let them watch it later. But this is a consistent theme that I'm noticing and I've been thinking about, which is that sporting events and even just public venues more broadly are not appropriate for children anymore. And another thing I've been thinking about are airplanes. Recently, my husband and I took our daughter on an international flight, and the man sitting next to her watched a movie that she still years later talks about how upsetting it was, the content on the movie. My husband was on a business trip last week, and he said the man in front of him was watching a show that was so graphically violent, he was struggling with whether or not to say something. But sporting events, I mean, this is a theme. Look at the Olympics and the performance that they had that was so vile and inappropriate and outright offensive to Christians. Look at the LA Dodgers, mocking nuns with drag. And I don't know, I was thinking about you, Lee, because you have teenage kids, and I don't know, how do you balance the challenge of, kids who enjoy sports, who want to watch these events, but shielding them from content that's just not appropriate.
It's hard. I think the same thing. I mean, I've heard those little voices like, this isn't appropriate, or even something like, a true crime series that they happen to, we think they're busy and they walk in and they're like, why are you watching this, mom and dad? So it's not even always just the broadcaster or the organization to blame. Because kids, I think, are really in tune to that sort of, thing that's inappropriate, or, if you've done a reasonable job up until that point, they can start to spot it on their own, what is normal content for them and what's not normal. I don't know. It is hard. I mean, my oldest is 20 now, so we kind of, we hope that he's got the tools to be able to discriminate what's going on out there. But clearly, I mean, he lives in his own apartment. And he watches sports constantly. But I think for him, I don't know, I at least feel like if he says, like, I can't believe they did that on TV, I feel like, okay. For the younger ones, it's a lot of distractions, I think, if you want to enjoy the sports, but
Well,
let's make
yeah, and Lee, now
themselves.
that every yeah, like not to, I just wanted to jump in because so what's really changed here fundamentally in terms of how our kids are protected is everybody going to streaming services rather than watching network TV. So I was at the hairdresser last week, and she's washing my hair and she's blowing my hair, and I'm just looking at something. I think it was I'm not even sure, Netflix or something, but it was sex scenes now between a married couple, but so graphic. I was like, why am I seeing this inside the hair salon?
Wow.
And so they're not,
They don't have the same FCC standards applied to them. And I know those who know me know I'm a critical, sorry, Criminal Minds junkie. And it's like my favorite show. And they have this new season now. It's not on the NBC network, but it's on Paramount Plus. And so, and I tell you, every other word's an F-bomb, you know? And I thought, what? And then some just very graphic, not just violence, but very graphic sex stuff. It stops at a certain point, anonymically, but it leaves nothing to the imagination. And I think that's a growing concern because parents, unless, you know, and we have every, because my husband's an IT security person, we have every filter known to God and man in our house, but still stuff seeps through. And I think that's a real issue with the streaming services.
But this is my point about like airplanes. I mean, if you go on an airplane, there is no FCC standard. I mean, you can turn on explicit R-rated content, and increasingly that's seeping into, in my opinion, even sporting events. And okay, you could say, sure, you could choose to never fly in an airplane, never take your child to a sporting event, but we've basically created a public square that's by definition not appropriate for young children. And I feel like we can do better than that. And I guess it's up to us as parents to push back. But you should be able to take your child on a plane and not worry about them seeing, you know, explicit language in the subtitles,
Right.
graphic sex scenes, and graphic violence.
Yeah. Well,
Well, it's
there's
even
more.
bad at restaurants. I mean, I find that if I want to take my grandchildren, like every restaurant that's not super fancy has TVs everywhere, and they're not used to that. And I find that my daughter says, "Well, Mom, depends what restaurant it is," which is really sad.
Yeah, because even ads, like during sporting events, it's not even just the like setups for the halftime shows. I mean, the ads that they show are really definitely scandalized my boys. I mean, I remember a long time ago, my eldest, because I was still like a big Condé Nast reader, I got all the glossy magazines, and I'd never even thought about it. But he said to me, "Mom, these magazines really make me uncomfortable." And so I ended all the subscriptions right then. But because I do think kids have that like innate sweet wholesomeness, but they shouldn't have to do their own filtering. It should be, you know, de rigueur to have family friendly ads if you have to have ads at a family friendly event like a sporting event.
Yeah, I mean, we had to actually pay somebody to come into our house. Because to your point about streaming services, we don't have cable TV. We just have a bunch of streaming services. But what we found was with a Roku TV, if you turn it on, there can be an ad for a show that is R-rated, and that's just turning the TV on. And we had to pay somebody who had to work the code from the back end to turn that off. There's no way to filter it for like make sure, you know, the ads are, because you can put on like your Disney Plus and your Netflix, make things to be, you know, set to G rated, but there's still the ads. And it's just, you know, but even that, I'm like, you know, people can choose to, you know, not have a TV or not let their children watch TV, but it seems like the simple act of taking your child out into public has become a like a Mario Kart experience of trying to dodge and distract from inappropriate content. And I think there's a real conversation to be had nationally about this in terms of what we are promoting at sporting events. Are sporting events now just an R-rated adult experience? Because that's kind of what it feels like as a mom.
No, I think a lot of it has to do with the economics of, you know, selling ad space and what ads for what products somehow, you know, in whatever calculation people who work in that, you know, in advertising, you know, figure out that what makes the most money and that's what they're going to do, you know, and I think they don't really care about our kids, unfortunately.
Well, so looking ahead to Super Bowl Sunday, I mean, fortunately, it's a ways off, so you have time to plan. But unfortunately, I think the Bad Bunny thing is a reminder that the entertainment industry does not care about your kids, and the onus is on us to protect them. I mean, I know we definitely turn off the halftime show and decide later if we're going to let our kids watch it. And there have been some that have been perfectly fun and fine. And you know, we've got YouTube, so you can let them watch it later. I know one mom who actually turns off all ads And I don't think that's a bad idea. I mean, whether it's a show that they're watching, I mean, we know that even streaming services now have ads, and they just straight up turn the ads off for anything that they're watching. And I think that's another smart option too. So those are two things that parents can be thinking about, but definitely, you always want to check and make sure all your streaming services are password protected. I mean, the industry is constantly moving the goalposts and changing things. So it's always healthy to do kind of like a little technology checkup on your home and make sure that settings and things are secure in this digital age with our kids.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our four fellows, Ashley McGuire, Mary Fiorito, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. Just recently, Lee Sneed writes about her forthcoming book on infertility, titled Infertile But Fruitful, and explains why she decided to write the book. So many people had responded to her columns and podcasts on her journey toward becoming an adoptive mother that she felt called to write a full-length book about it. In Lessons from the Turnaway Study, Mary Fiorito writes about mothers who wanted to abort their children initially, but were turned away for various reasons and had a very different take on their initial decision as years passed. And Betsy Fentress writes on hospitality and the will to live about a friend's father and a family friend with no relatives who were brought back to life by food, attention, and love. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com. And we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations.
We're coming up on November, which of course is the month of All Souls. I know that Monsignor Landry's organization, the Pontifical Mission Societies, they accept something called Gregorian Masses for any time of year, but it's particularly done during November for the Holy Souls in Purgatory, where you have 30 consecutive masses said for 30 days for one particular deceased person. Who may still be in purgatory. Very few priests can accept that particular request because, 30 consecutive days is not easy to do in a parish, but missionary priests can, and it's a way to support them and then also to support the holy souls in purgatory. So we might ask Monsignor Landry about that the next time he's with us to talk about how important those Gregorian masses are and that his organization is a trustworthy organization that then will be able to give those stipends to a priest in a mission country.
Well, with all the negative news in the world, it's exciting to have two positive stories to reflect on this week. And that's really the beauty of the clips is, we don't turn away from the negative stories. We look at them, we analyze them in the clips, but we also help to draw out those hopeful stories that we're, as Catholics called to reflect on and be a part of. And so we commend our clip service to all of our listeners. Every morning, the Catholic Association reviews all of the latest news and sends our subscribers a carefully curated collection of the most important news of the day. Items are specifically selected for a smart Catholic audience like you. Don't let the world take you by surprise. Subscribe to our daily media roundup at thecatholicassociation.org. Betsy and Mary, thanks for reflecting on the news of the week with us today.
Thanks,
Great to
Ashley.
be with you.